Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of The Broadway Breakdown. I am one of your queens on the pod, Matt Koplik.
And I am the other one who just got off the pod, John Miscavige. Our energy levels could not be more different right
now.
They
could not be.
Like, you were so, like, 30 and thriving, and I'm so, like, 70 and dead.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying I'm 30. That's a fucking lie, everybody.
He's 32.
I just moisturize every day. No, honestly, it's partly the fact that I just got off work and I had a lot of chocolate before this. So I'm like bouncing off the walls.
Nice.
Yeah, and John is valiantly here with us. He's not well, but he...
Let me speak.
Oh my God.
I'm not well.
He's not well, but he loves me and he loves this podcast, so he decided to commit to it.
And we have a special guest who's going to be joining us today.
Yes, Broadway producer Lucas McMahon. Lucas is running a little bit late, which happens when you're busy and very important.
Yes. But I had some business that I wanted to cover anyways. Basically, I texted Matt last night because I just had this epiphany. I didn't realize that high schoolers knew about podcasts. I don't know. I guess it's because I didn't discover them until I was about 28. And so I've had some really fun, cool little stroke the ego interactions with people on social media that have expressed that they are fans of the podcast. I've been like tagged in posts before about people who listen to this and kind of quoting things. And, you know, that's always cool.
I've had none of that.
Well, no, I'm sexy. I'm like a really sexy baby.
Oh my
baby.
God, people just like John on this podcast. I should just go away.
No. I don't mean it like that. I just mean if you were to reach out to one of us, you are much smarter and probably more intimidating. I'm kind of the attainable one. I'm the every gay, every man gay.
And I will be fair, I'm not very prominent on social media.
Yeah.
I'm like not, I have a Facebook, I don't use
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And my Instagram is like once a week, if yeah. that.
And you know, sometimes things of mine go a little viral. And so it just opens that door.
Sure,
Jan. But anyways, so I've witnessed that there are some youngins who listen to it, but I thought they were college age or whatnot. And then last night, and I'm sure you're listening, and I don't mean this to knock you. I appreciate you, listener.
We see you, we appreciate you.
I see you, I hear you. I was just worried that To Catch a Predator was going to jump out. At any moment, because basically, I get this message last night on Facebook Messenger, and it was from someone that I know has tagged me before and has mentioned that they're a fan of the podcast, so they were kind of on my radar, mm-hmm. But I don't really know them, and they sent me a Facebook message last night, and I kind of thought, oh, okay, and so I read it, and it was someone going, hey, hold on, maybe I should just read it, They said to me, I am saying words to fill the time while I get this up on my phone. Here we go. They go, hey, sorry for the random Facebook message, but I'm in dire need of help. My senior quote is due tomorrow, and I have a list I need to narrow down. And then they send a bunch of quotes that actually are quotes that I find funny as well from different TV shows, different things, blah, 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 different musical theater quotes. Mm-hmm. But my mind, I went, senior quote? I thought, oh, I guess, do you do senior quotes? In my mind, I thought, of course, this person who's a listener who, they have to be in college. Anyone who's under the age of 18 doesn't know how to search for this. They can't find us. We are not responsible for corrupting the youth. And then, so I kind of sent back something that was along the lines of, haha, am I qualified to do this? And then he said something like, you are probably overqualified to pick a high schooler's senior quote. And I just said, you know, just immediately flashing red lights. Chris Hansen walked out of a different door room and said, what do you think you're doing here, John? It was just an episode of To Catch a Predator. And so it just took me aback. Reader, I'm not shaming you. I appreciate you reaching out. I appreciate you seeking the wisdom of someone who is obviously much smarter than everyone. Mm-hmm. Everyone the look on Matt's face. But I just, it just, and so I texted Matt and just kind of a tizzy going, youngins, listen to this and take our advice or maybe think things that we're saying are, I just got worried that we that there's a lawsuit a-brewing.
Oh my God. Well, okay. This is coming off by the fact, by the way, anyone who actually listens to my part of this podcast knows that I always talk about how my family
someone has a chip on their shoulder. Do you need some dip for that chip, bitch?
I do. I do too.
I'm very quite hungry.
It's very earnest. I really do. I talk about how my family doesn't know how to find podcasts, except for like my cousin and my sister. Hi, Scott. By the way, if you're listening, hey, bitch.
Hi, Scott.
But he's the only one. My dad asks me at dinner last night, "How do I get your podcast to play in the car?" And I go,
abort, abort, well, abort.
I say, I'm not going to tell you. He goes, why? I go, I don't need you to hear how I talk on this podcast. And he goes, what makes you think I haven't listened to it already? And I go,
butthole just literally, yeah, it just, yeah, oh dear God.
Mm-hmm. And I just go, I'm trying to play it so cool. It's like if your parents catch porn on your computer or something, like, what do you mean? And yeah. He's like, oh, I've listened to it. And I go, please tell me just the first episode. He goes, no, I'm not going to tell you how many, but I've listened to quite a lot. And he goes, and I know how you talk now. And I just go, ah!
Oh, no.
This is the same man, though, by the way, who introduced me to Boys in the Band, The Birdcage, Some Like It Hot, who literally hit, like, I think Peter Koplik's moment of 2018 was going to see Boys in the Band live on stage on Broadway. That was like his moment supreme.
Yes,
he
queen.
Was so excited. Yes. And then the first thing he said when he walked into the theater was, not a lot of women here.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
So here's the thing. After we recorded the last episode, I ended up watching The Princess Switch with one Sarah Deviney. Hi, Sarah. You got shouted out again.
Oh, my gosh. What did you think?
Oh, my God. We lived for all of it. So the old man that, like, constantly pops up, the one who's like, how could I be in Chicago? Who serves no purpose.
No purpose.
But he's, like, all over the place. We just and he had no name. We just called him Magique.
Yeah.
So he walked around. We're like, there's Magique again. And the movie also has this weird trend where people will just divulge personal information to strangers.
Exactly.
So it's
delicious.
It's amazing. So the basic premise is that Vanessa Hudgens is a baker in Chicago whose heart gets broken, and her best friend and sous chef, which, like, bakers don't have sous chefs.
I know
fine.
They don't. I know. That was, it was just such, it was such a cherry on the cake, which is a phrase I'm bringing back from last week. It was such a cherry on the cake.
And also, even though they filmed the entire thing in Los Angeles, I know that they did, because the palace they use in Belgravia, the fake Genovia country, the palace is the same hall they use on Gilmore Girls for all of the Chilton
yes.
events.
It's so obviously
ridiculous. Like, but But to like make sure that we all understand that they are from Chicago, Vanessa Hudgens is always wearing a Chicago baseball cap.
No.
And it just all it's just a baseball cap that says Chicago in cursive. It's great. But so she's like, I'm not gonna do this whole baking contest. Whatever. I like order, I like plans. She runs into her ex and his new girlfriend, who's like, oh, I don't know who you are. He's never said anything about you. Let me tell you everything that's going on in my life. And I'm like,
no.
And I remember saying to Sarah, it's like, she's saying a lot of information to someone who, to her, is a stranger. And then the same thing happens later with, like, the Queen of Belgravia talking to Majik about, like, oh, there are duplicates of them. And I'm like, as far as she knows, he's just the gardener. Why is she telling him all this?
There's also a scene where someone falls from a possibly fourth-story balcony, yes! And doesn't die.
Doesn't die.
Doesn't even get really injured.
No, there's a moment where I'm like, he's dead, because his eyes are closed, and then all of a sudden he groans, and then he just pops back up like fucking Jason in Friday the 13th. It's insane.
This movie, if you have not watched it, I know it's not Christmas anymore. I cannot recommend it enough. Also has one of the best, just, the little girl.
Oh, I called her expositional 8-year-old.
The little girl that keeps popping up who, I'm sorry, I love supporting child actors, but she is without a doubt the worst child actor ever.
In her defense, literally every
she has no defense. No. She's trash.
Fuck you, 8-year-old, and all the high schoolers who support us.
Yeah.
This whole episode is basically just we hate children.
No.
But no, I know what you mean. No, this girl, this poor girl, all of her dialogue, granted most child actors are terrible, but and maybe she'll grow up to be good. I hope she is. But all of her dialogue is simply exposition. Like, it's always, Vanessa Hudgens, since your boyfriend of 3 years dumped you 2 months ago, or my father, whose wife left him nine years ago.
No, I'm not talking about that little girl. I'm talking about the little girl who has two brief cameos, who at the
end... In the orphanage?
Yes, who at the end tugs on her wedding gown or whatever it is, and goes, are you a real princess now? Like, she seems like a Katya character.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the expositional 8-year-old.
No, not... Because fuck her, because I don't care about her. She was annoying as fuck. But what I'm talking about is the little girl who I was scream laughing at, who...
Are you a real person?
She was the creepiest little I think they wanted a cute 8-year-old, and for some reason they found the sociopath 8-year-old who was sitting there just going... Oh, gee, are you a real princess? It's so bizarre.
The entire movie is bonkers, and I love everything about it.
If there isn't a drinking game to it, I need to create one, because
yes.
I was dying.
Well, you can do a drinking game for schedule, because she does say it a bit.
I told you about the schedule.
Schedule. She does say it a bit. Not as often as I was hoping about it, because I made a count of it, because you told me about it. So yeah. I'm such an asshole. I was telling it as
it has to be somewhere in the 20s.
No, it's not. It's because the Duchess or whatever doesn't show up until like 20 minutes into the movie.
Well, then you and I just have different years.
Really, I'm just saying, because it's not a lot. It's just a lot in a very short amount of time. So like for like half an hour, she says it like 15 times, and then she doesn't say it again.
Here comes Matt again with his facts and his reason, and just truly. Just trying to.
This is why nobody asks me to pick their senior yearbook quote.
Because you're not the fun mom.
I'm not.
I'm the fun mom. Sure, you might die. Sure, I don't care about you. Sure, I don't give a fuck about any of.
You're Julia Roberts and I'm Susan Sarandon. It's fine.
Well, everyone's always known that.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm Susan Sarandon. I don't want to be.
Neither does she. You best believe Susan Sarandon does not want to be Susan Sarandon
anymore. Who wants to peek at Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Oof.
I know. So, let's pretend for a second that Lucas just walked through the door, and I'll say, here's Lucas, let's take a short break! And then we'll cut to, I'm back to live with you. And then we'll be like, and Lucas is here!
Cool.
Great. I will continue to talk right now and pretend that we're having a conversation. Lucas is here!
Oh my God, that was the most set up bullshit I've ever witnessed. But yes, Lucas is here. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
Well, guys, we're back, and Matt almost just killed himself. He's so excited about our guest that he tripped over himself. But we're all here. We're alive.
And we have with us Lucas McMahon. Hi, Lucas.
Hello. How you doing? We're going to say, for the record, I don't think I am worth falling over for in the manner that you just did.
I don't think it was me.
I do think it was just how hard it is to push the button on that recording. That's a difficult job.
Don't cut yourself short.
That's a very nice suit you're wearing, Lucas.
Oh, thank you.
You are dressed exceptionally well. John and I look like garbage.
I'm wearing a unicorn t-shirt and like an Old Navy sweater.
When you're doing a podcast in which people will definitely not see what you're wearing, it's important to look your best.
That's very true.
You know.
I
feel like they can feel it through the airwaves.
I can feel the pattern of that tie from over here.
That's like I brushed my teeth before this, and because I was like, oh, I have to have fresh breath for the podcast.
Listen, if we do this right, they will be able to visualize the pattern of my tie while people are at the gym or at work or whatever they're doing while they're listening to a podcast.
On the toilet, maybe while you're at a show, I don't know.
Waiting in line for rush tickets to... Oh God.
I would say I listen to a lot of podcasts and almost always I'm in transit or doing something else, which I think is 90% of people watch podcasts, but there's like been a couple podcasts that were so engrossing that I just sat, and namely it was Dirty John, which was this, where I just sat in my apartment on a Saturday and listened to it like a radio play. Like I was an old man in 1941 listening to his stories on the radio. I was like, I have a TV. I have the ability to go places. I was literally just sitting there listening to, you know, this huckster, destroyed this family as my Saturday. That was what I did on my day off. So.
Let's hope that that's how people listen to this episode. I want it to be like that, but more Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction.
I did that once for a period of my life last year where I was listening to podcasts in a similar manner, but for some reason it was always while I was taking baths. I don't know why. I had to draw.
That sounds hazardous, actually.
I had a Bluetooth speaker that is waterproof that I would keep, and then I would keep my phone in the other room because I know not to trust myself. But yeah, I would draw a bath. It was very 1940s. It was very film noir. It was very gay.
It's funny you say that about your phone. It's a little bit of a tangent, but I just went to this conference where there was a speaker who was talking about communication and basically revealed that scientists have determined that even the presence of your phone in your presence, just seeing it, sends your brain into fight or flight mode. And it was like the clouds opened up on my life. I was like, that is so fucking true. I just want to say, you just gave me an epiphany.
Thank you.
I just want to say, I haven't reformed any of my behaviors. My phone is always still in my presence. But
that's how we all are.
But I did understand the like general anxiety we all have at all times based on that statement.
Oh, yeah.
Once again, made no change to my behavior. But but I know myself a little better now.
It's good to be aware.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't know much about people, but I do know television, and that's pretty much everything on television. All these characters have epiphanies and don't change.
Exactly.
So let's get into the deets, everybody. In case you're wondering why you should listen to Lucas McMahon today on this podcast, let me run it down for you.
You shouldn't end the podcast.
So thanks for joining us, Lucas.
Please subscribe, like us, 5 stars. Lucas McMahon is the Broadway producer. I mean, that's true. That's not a lie. I'm not leaning into anything.
Let me say that
in real person voice. Lucas is a Broadway producer. He has produced Something Rotten, Hand to God, Mike Birbiglia is the new one. You had another one recently.
Play That Goes Wrong.
Yes. And then I went up on IBDb because I wanted to make sure I wasn't forgetting anything. You also produced the tour of Motown?
I work with a producer named Kevin McCollum who I've worked with for about six and a half years now. So when we were doing Motown, I was not a producer on Motown, but I did work on the show the whole time.
How old are you, Lucas?
I'm 29.
So everybody, anyone who tells you life's not a race, answer them with, what about fucking Lucas McMahon? Just so you know.
That's not true. We are all you know, we're all in our own race.
Don't bullshit.
Don't fucking bullshit.
Don't about your own personal race.
This is
what
stupid.
What kind of like think or like feel good about yourself kind of podcast? Do you think
I didn't bring you onto this podcast, Lucas, to have you make me feel good about myself.
I am so sorry.
So how did you get into producing?
So I always kind of knew I wanted to be on the production end of theater. I fell in love with theater when I was a little kid, like most people did. I remember I always say that like my first production I was in when I was, I think, six or seven, and it was Snow White and the Five Dwarfs because I did not have enough kids for seven.
Budget.
So I feel like I've told this story recently. It's almost like who got cut. And I was like, I believe what happened was it wasn't so much cutting, whereas they combined two of the dwarves. So, like, there was one dwarf that was sleepy bashful, I believe. Because they...
So resourceful.
Whatever. I forget the woman's name who, like, directed it, but she just decided that, like, the emotions of sleepy and bashful were, like, somewhat close enough to each other that could just be one person.
But sure. I also feel like that makes that character semi-depressed.
Dealing with deep depression
and not wanting to see people.
Clinically depressed.
Yeah.
Walking Zoloft commercial.
Can interact with other people. It's great.
Yeah, that is true. It's not, if someone was like, the two qualities I most associate with a person is they are always asleep and they are very bashful, I'd be like, they need to see a therapist immediately.
Please seek.
That's not good.
Snow White and the Five Dwarfs brought to you by Zoloft.
Zoloft. Yeah, we weren't smart enough for corporate sponsors back then. I don't know if Zoloft
neither
existed. But I did that, and I always, by the way, I was dopey, obviously.
But of course.
And even back then, I would say, like, I remember doing that. I remember I was way more interested in, like, all of the parents that they guilted into doing, like, the set and the light board and the cost, like, all just putting it together and, like, the posters and crap. I always thought that was way more interesting. And so at that age, I was like, I want to do, you know, I want to be on, like, that side of doing this, which is exceedingly odd for a child to be like, I want to be in, I don't want to be on stage.
You can have that spotlight. Give me a marker and a dream. You know?
But so that's kind of when I knew what I wanted to do. Flash forward to high school where they had a great theater program that involved the opportunities for students to direct and produce. And that's when I, you know, started producing things and really found, I was like, this is what I love. This is kind of what I feel like fits my skill set best. And kind of thought maybe that's what it was, but I didn't really know what it was, so I started doing it. And even that was a very, you know, low stakes version of it. But I did love it. So I went to Northwestern University primarily because they had a huge student theater community, and that was super important to me. And so that was really great. You know, shout out to Northwestern.
Hey, Northwestern.
I was going to just say they don't pay me, but not only did they not pay me, I paid them a lot of money, and they continue to ask me for more. So, yeah. after college, during college, I did several internships in New York. I interned for a press agency that does Broadway, what's called the Hartman Group, which no longer exists. Interned for a company called Serena Coin, which is an advertising and marketing agency that does Broadway. And when I graduated, I had a job, which was about a six-month gig, as the press agent for the Williamstown Theater Festival. So I was there the summer that they were doing, Bradley Cooper and Patricia Clarkson were doing The Elephant Man there, and Blythe Danner was doing this new play there, that Bob Balaban was directing, and,
if only they had names there.
Yeah.
Those shows could have gone places.
I was an apprentice there, and my summer, we had none of that shit. It was like, it was like two actors you never heard of doing True West. Why is no one showing up?
David Hyde Pierce and Tyne Daly were there, doing
Meryl Streep was running concessions.
Importance of being earnest, and it was like, so it was this great group of people. Right around the time that I was actually about to go to Williamstown, a friend of mine from college, who worked for Kevin McCollum, was Kevin McCollum used to have a business partner named Jeffrey Seller. They had a company called The Producing Office, and they had decided to split the company and do different things. And so my friend who worked with them was like, hey, you know, Kevin's starting a company. He's kind of just looking for an assistant, Man Friday, to like kind of do everything. I think you guys would get along. Can I set up a meeting? And I was like, yeah, totally. And you know, Kevin had been someone who, you know, as someone who wanted to be a Broadway producer and was like a huge nerd about all kinds of things happening on Broadway. Like, you know, Kevin was a real kind of idol of mine. I hope he doesn't listen to this, because then he will never let me live down.
That he was an idol of yours?
Saying it, but no, he knows it. So so I was like, yeah, of course. And so we met, and basically, you know, we hit it off. And after that, I essentially called him and said in a nice and politic way, like, I'm not gonna let you not hire me. So like, when am
what,
I starting?
What we gotta do? Yeah,
basically. So, and he foolishly took the bait. And, so anyway, so I started working there, September of 2012. And it was really like an old school mentorship, which I'm, you know, incredibly grateful for. It was like every, you know, it was about 9 months from when I started is when we Motown opened up Broadway.
Wow.
And so when I started, like a month afterwards, we were about to go into a lab for the show, a workshop for the show. And, you know, I kind of assumed, I was like, I'm going to come here, I'm going to make appointments, I'm going to make, you know, schedule things. And from day one, Kevin was like, okay, we're going to go, we have to go negotiate some contracts, so get up, come on, we're going to go do this. And he just took me to literally everything possible for, you know, the entire year. It was really like, it was insane, because it was like the best grad school you could ever hope for, but
right.
But like, I was getting paid. It was insane. I was like, I just kept hoping that like he wouldn't figure out that I would do it for free, because then I wouldn't be able to buy food and like pay for rent. But
all right.
But I was like, but I would have taken that deal. So it was really fantastic. And basically from there, kind of grew, and what I did grew, and because he had kind of allowed me to, you know, be a part of so much so early, I was able to kind of start being a lot more useful to the company. And now, you know, about 6.5 years later, you know, basically, you know, we work together on stuff, and I still work at the company called Alchemation. And, you know, we kind of tag team stuff. I would say sometimes if Kevin has like the 80,000 foot view, I take like the 60,000 foot view on everything we're doing. And, you know, we have a bunch of projects that we kind of, you know, tag team on some of them. Some of them I kind of do most of the day to day and stuff. So it's, yeah, it's great. And that's kind of the story in brief.
In brief.
Which was really, really long, with a lot of long tangents. If anyone, anyone who knows me, and Matt knows me, knows that like in brief for me is like, you're here like 3 days later. Yeah. I'm like, and you're like, this is the fucking short version? It's like, yeah, this is his short version.
Well, yes, I do. Lucas let the cat out of the bag. I have known Lucas for 15 years, everybody.
Oh my God, is that how long it is?
Yeah, 16. It'll be 16 this summer. We were 13 years old at Stage Romantic Performing Arts Center.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Nice. Actually, so for those of you who find me insufferable with all my historical insight and knowledge,
Why are you looking at me?
Why are you looking at me when you say that? Who should I be looking at, John?
Lucas.
You do have actually Lucas McMahon to blame for that, I will say, because I was very much a theater nerd all my life, and I went to Stage Door for the first time believing that I knew the most any 13-year-old could know about Broadway. And, like, let me just be clear. I knew, like, statistics. I knew how many performances the original Sounding Music ran. Like, stupid number shit. I didn't know, like, a lot of historical background. Lucas, like, claps back at me very first. First of all, you were very nice. He was the first run I ever made at Stage Door. We were roommates, thank God. But literally, like, grabs me by the hand, tours me around Stage Door, and, like, goes through each theater. One of the theater's names was The Merman, in which Lucas then, like, gives me 5 minutes of historical knowledge about Ethel Merman. I was like, I don't know any of that shit. And then it just...
By the way, it wasn't even called The Merman because that. It was called The Merman because it was next to an disgusting indoor pool.
But that's why it was called the Mermaid?
I think it was partially both. I think it was like, that was kind of the, they were like, oh, it's funny that it's like Ethel Merman and also this is, shares a wall with a
with the now no
rotting pool. Yeah, they've taken out the pool.
Yes, yeah, so it's now become a theater in the round because they're like, what are we doing having two pools with kids who only want to do shows?
When we were at Secret Remainder, there was like some sort of presumption that they like maybe there would be some sort of like wave of the kids there being like, we want to do some sort of athletic activity. So, like,
oh, yeah, was there a basketball hoop or anything?
There was.
There's no. one.
But it was, like, overgrown and gross. And there was,
one
like,
singular hoop.
It was a volleyball tournament. But, like, no one. And then everyone would like, do free swim as one of their things. But not to swim. It was just to sit on the side and learn your lines. Like, it was. Oh, yeah. So.
Well, because you weren't allowed in the pool unless you did the swim test. So most kids were like, great, I just won't do the swim test. My very first summer, I did.
I forgot that detail.
Yeah. Well, no, I remember this. I remember this, and I'm quoted as saying this, by the way, in the New York Times for anyone who wants to find it, but my very first summer, I did it, and literally you and Brian Waller were standing by the pool going, Matt, what are you doing? And I was like, are we, because I came from 4 summers of a sports camp, miserable 4 summers of my life, where that was mandatory, and I was like, aren't we supposed to do this? She's like, you don't have to. We're like doing fucking Little Women in the play Little Women, and like, I don't know, Mame. Why do you think the swim test is mandatory?
Yeah, the swim test was not super not mandatory. It was pretty hysterical. It was like the but yeah, ever since then, Sager's gotten wiser, and they've just turned like every athletic facility they had
has just become
into a theater or some sort of like rehearsal space.
Do you know the volleyball tournament's still a thing though? Because that's hysterical.
It was like it was a cast-to-cast volleyball tournament in which essentially it was like groups of like 25 truly unathletic, uncoordinated teenagers with equally, if not more so, unathletic and uncoordinated. And I will, I'm not going to say this on air. They were probably drunk counselors. Not the students. The kids were up. But the counselors were like, they were just, allegedly. They're just going to call me and be like, I'm so mad at you.
Does it still exist?
Yeah, it stays.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Oh, my God,
super
absolutely.
Much so,
It's my first summer at Stage Door was probably the last summer that Stage Door was, like, truly Stage Door because things were, like, falling apart, run down.
Oh, yeah,
We were doing super un-PC shows for kids. I loved it. I loved it so much.
They did Follies.
Yeah, that was
like
my
15-year-olds did Follies, and it was,
oh my God,
like the young Phyllis was older than the old Phyllis.
Here's the thing about Stage Door though: the summer after my first summer, the movie Camp came out, which was based on and filmed at Stage Door.
True.
Like, was it filmed there too?
Oh yeah. Like everything was filmed in either the LC or the Playhouse, which are two theaters at Stage Door.
Yeah.
But I remember because the movie wasn't like this big blockbuster hit. Anna Kendrick always talks about like, oh, the movie totally bombed, and I'm like, it kind of put Stage Door on the map, or back on the map anyway, because after that, they were sold out every summer. Mm. Things were starting to get renovated. They were adding new theaters. They were doing more, like, commercially shows, which was fine, but I missed kids doing Follies and Company. Like, 17-year-old Jacob, now Kemp, singing Being Alive like he meant it. And I was like, Stevie Booth shattering that glass.
I completely forgot about Company. Yeah,
yeah,
it was
they did
like
Company.
They were just like, access your embittered, like, 35-year-old. Everyone's like, I'm 17 and I think life's great. We're going to do these shows about disillusioned people looking back on their past and struggling with their regrets.
And the way that...
Right in their wheelhouse.
I totally understand how contestants on reality shows become so crazy because when that becomes your world for so long, you just stop seeing reality.
Yes.
Because kids would start predicting what shows were going to be like 6 months in advance. And like, well, I heard from so-and-so. And then I remember my last summer, your last summer.
Yes.
Lucas left the summer before I did. I found Stage Door works in sessions, 1, 2, and 3. Each one's 3 weeks. They do a whole round of new shows every session. And you can do 1, you can do 2, you can do 3. Lucas left at the end of second session, as did I. And I found out before we were leaving, they were doing the producers the third session. And Both of our mothers had told Connie Cottrell, who was basically in charge of picking the shows, for the last 2 years that Lucas and I needed to do the producers together. And Connie was
robbed.
I remember Connie being
better.
Connie was like, it's too mature. And then that was the summer they do it, like Lucas's last summer, and they do it this session after he left.
Yeah.
And I threw such a fit that I look back on, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you? There's so much more to life than not doing the producers with your friend. Like, fuck off.
I do hope that all of the campers take it as seriously.
Oh, I hope so too.
I'm sure they do.
I'm sure they do as well. Yeah. And I will say, for any parents out there, it's a really wonderful place to send your kid who's like,
oh, no, please do it.
Please send your kid there. But it also is like an endless source of comedy in my life because you look back on it and you're like, number one, what were we doing? And number two, why did we care very deep? Like, I was in a class, and like the teacher who taught it no longer teaches there. And it was like we learned no acting in this class. Like, we did not learn any acting. And the teacher was like, and if there is a documentary about Stay Shore, and there is a scene in the documentary in which like this class, I'm not in the class. Yeah. Though I think later.
That was our second summer.
Yeah. It was, but anyway, so this guy basically would get you in a circle and basically ask you like really personal, uncomfortable questions. Yeah. Like, and the example, which is on film for all of you to go enjoy, which was he basically made everyone in the class say who they thought should leave the class because like they weren't talented enough.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it's like a bunch of, you know, 14 to 17 year olds who are, you know, no one's killing it at that stage of their life. And if you are killing it at that stage of your life, you weren't at Stage Four Manor.
No.
And so everyone's like awkward and a teenager and like just hoping people like them.
Oh yeah.
And you have to go around and basically say like which kid you think should be thrown out of the class. And everyone was like, this is how we become stars.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
To be young again.
To be like again. Lucas, what are some misconceptions about being a producer? What are questions you're tired of having to correct when people are like, oh, you're a producer, so you must do this?
It's a really good question. I think that I think a lot of people have the misconception that it is just raising money, or I think a lot of people have a conception, or I think a lot of people don't understand what it really encompasses, and I think that they also think that producers are, particularly commercial producers. I mean, there's, just to clarify, I'm a commercial producer, so basically I work on shows, and mainly, you know, Broadway's commercial, so these shows are kind of built as businesses to make money, to hopefully make money.
Right.
You don't say.
Whereas a nonprofit, which has like a season of shows, the Public or Roundabout and stuff like that, are set up differently, so they're not for-profit entities. And so a lot of people think commercial Broadway producers are, out for money, or it's all about the money and the bottom line.
I think a nice tie.
I'm just saying. But I do think that that's a misconception, because I think our job is to give the right resources to the creative team in order to make the best work possible. And that's like how the show is going to succeed. You know, we're not sitting there kind of counting dimes and saying, you can't have that costume. Mm-hmm. You can't have this. It's so, I think one of the biggest roles of a producer is to really like facilitate the collaboration on the show. And it's not just among the creative team. It's also with, you know, your marketing folks, and it's with your general managers, and it's with your press agent, and kind of everyone that works on the show, and making sure everyone's kind of working towards one shared goal. Mm.
I'll let John talk in a second.
No, it's okay. I'm just enjoying this.
I remember getting coffee with you around the time, it was three or four months before Something Rotten was announced to come to Broadway.
Yes.
And you told me about it. I was like, this sounds like so much fun.
Yeah.
And then it was announced, like, oh, this is so exciting. I think that Something Rotten is probably the best example in recent memory of a Broadway show where the marketing was so in tune with the show that it really rose the profile of that show. Like, that people were talking about Something Rotten before it even opened because the advertising was so good.
Yeah.
And no one felt bamboozled when they finally saw it. They're like, oh, this is exactly what I came to see.
Yeah, and there were so many smart little aspects of the advertising, of like the lead up to, because I mean, obviously, an original musical is a scary thing for a producer, I must imagine. Because there's
the scariest, I would say.
Yeah. Well, just because it's impossible to have a preconceived notion.
Yeah.
You literally don't know, but there were just so many smart little things. I remember seeing it in previews, and I remember... what was it? That you could get tickets during the preview that were the same price of the year that it was set.
Oh yeah, $15.95.
Yeah, and I remember just, I think it was even for only the first or the second preview. But I remember I saw the first or the second preview and it was amazing. But I remember seeing that and going, "What a smart idea!"
Oh, I'm glad
because you're getting people in the seats. Yeah. And people don't know what it's about. It's going to be a word of mouth thing, and that's what it was in New York. Where, you know, like yes, the advertising, but one of the biggest allies to a new show was word of mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thank you for those compliments. And I have to say, like, a lot of the credit, there was a big team of people who worked on that. Spocko is the advertising agency. And I believe the $15.95 idea was, I think it was Kevin's, and we were all kind of just brainstorming ways about exactly how to get people. And I really think at the end of the day, it's all about word of mouth. And the best thing you can do is create a campaign that accurately reflects what your show is, and then have the show deliver. Because, you know, you can, it's interesting. I think that, I think it's kind of proven again and again. It's like some shows are much easier to pre-sell than other shows because they have a big star or a big brand or, a big title or, and I think, but I think it proves that like the real longevity of a show is really based on word of mouth and the show really delivering on the expectations that the audiences walk into. So I think about that a lot on a show, and you have to think about how your advertising matches up with that. For that show, we were all like, we just need to get as many people in here as possible immediately, and to feel like they won something, because like I'm sitting in a great seat for less than $16, and I feel great about it. And so we were like, if we can fill the theater with like 1,600 people who feel like they just felt like they like won something by being at one of these performances, we're gonna generate some word of mouth for people who don't know what the show is or are like,
and
what is that? And you know,
and you did like,
yeah, you truly
you did that. Yeah. The show ran for nearly 2 years with no like major Hollywood names. That's not based on anything.
Yeah.
Like that's such a great achievement.
Well, and if I remember correctly, was there going to be an out of town tryout, and then that was kind of nixed, or was there never going
to
be?
No, there was.
Which I always thought was really brave of that because it's you know.
So kind of basically what happened was we were supposed to go out of town to the Fifth Avenue in Seattle.
Yes.
And I actually remember, so we did a workshop of the show, and the people from Seattle came to see the show, and one of them just looked at us after and it was like a really real. It was the first time the show was on its feet ever, and Brian, Darcy James, and Christian Borle hadn't been in any of the previous developmental stuff we had done. And it was the first time they were in it, and just like all kind of really clicked. I remember someone from Seattle looked at us and were like, "Oh, you're not coming to Seattle? Like, what?" You're like, "Why would you do that?" And you know, I think there's so much value to going out of town, like even if you're in one of those positions. But I think, you know, theater became available, and we just felt like we need to kind of roll the dice and go for it.
Oh, they were being... Sorry, I totally took that as shade, not as them being nice. They're
no.
like... They'd be like, you're not bringing this to Seattle.
No. It was like... It was
like, it's ready.
Yeah, that's great.
They felt like... They were like, yeah, it's ready. Why would you... You know, and so... And they were really phenomenal, because we did have to... You know, we had announced it, and we ended up having to... you know, pull out of the slot, and they were really phenomenal because they were like, go, you know, we were like, we just think
go fly.
Yeah, we're like, we just think this is the right decision for the show, and they agreed, and so we ended up doing it. But because of that, we needed to kind of ramp up really quickly and just get a lot of people in because it was a title no one had heard of.
Yeah.
You know, its authors are all really well known in like their very specific circles. Carey Kirkpatrick is a screenwriter and a director of like a lot of very popular animated films, and Wayne Kirkpatrick actually wrote Change the World with Eric Clapton and is a Grammy winner. John O'Farrell is like a very popular writer in the UK. But they weren't like household names that everyone kind of would say, oh, you know, that's you know, a songwriter I know. So we're like, we needed to get people in and start talking about the show. And we also wanted, because the show celebrated musicals, we wanted people who were like those Broadway people who were going to see like $15 tickets to a show, like, we're going.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually who we wanted to be in those seats. So
Yeah.
And like get the chess reference and act two and all that crap. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It was written main for us. okay. John,
I actually have another question.
Go for it.
Sorry. So kind of then the flip side of that, I mean, you've produced a lot of shows that I've just loved so much over the last couple of years. And probably one of my favorite shows, hands down, over the last couple of years, was Hand to God.
Oh, great.
And so, I don't know everything about the trajectory of that, but I know that that play had been around for a while.
Yeah.
I know, and so I was wondering, was that something where you came, were you guys involved kind of from the beginning? Or was that something that kind of was different where it had kind of gained some momentum and then the choices were made?
Yeah. Interesting. A little of both. So that, Kevin saw that show at
Because where was I was trying to think of
it was at the Ensemble Studio Theater.
Yep.
Actually, this is kind of a great story. The Ensemble Studio Theater is a great theater. The director Moritz von Stupnagel and Rob Askins Stephen Boyer, who was the star of that show, and Stephen Boyer's now wife. So they have this thing called the Young Blood Company, and they did this thing where they everyone basically created one-act plays, and they, like, drew names out of a hat, like, the first day. And that's how they all met. Like, they all drew names out of the hat. And so it was just, like, just think about, you know, one of them met their wife that way. And,
right.
And they all met their collaborators that way. Like,
draw
really,
more names out of hats,
exactly. It's a great way to do it. So anyway, so they had a long collaboration with the Ensemble Studio Theater. And Rob really wrote this play with Stephen and Geneva in mind. And Moritz, so they did it at the Ensemble Studio Theater. It had gotten a little bit of traction. Kevin went to go see it. This was before I had started working at Alchemation. I think probably like just a few months before. I think it was like maybe 3 or 4 months before. And he'd gone with a producer named Roy Miller, who also produced Drowsy Chaperone with Kevin, who unfortunately passed away about a year later. Roy was like, there's this great show. You need to come see it. Kevin went to go see it, and he said, you know, he walked up to Rob and was like, I really love your play. Is it done yet? And Rob said, well, I don't think it's ever done. And Kevin was like, great, right answer, because the show was so great, but it still, you know, had some work to do. So, then Kevin started working on it. I started working on it when I started there in 2012, and then we opened up Broadway, I think, in 2015. So I worked on it for like 3 years, and it was... So from there, we went to MCC Theater, which is another great theater.
Yes.
They just opened up a whole new space on 52nd Street. And so they really wanted to do the play. And so Stephen, Geneva, Moritz were all there. We brought on a new design team and really, really worked on the play. It was in a bigger space. You know, the Ensemble Studio Theater is like a super small, maybe 50-seat theater.
Right.
You know, MCC was an off-Broadway 250-seat theater. And the show just, so we were involved in that entire process leading up to that, which was a multi-year process. And I think that happened in sometime in 2014. And the show just got a huge response, at MCC, and people, you know, just, it was this, you know, got amazing reviews and huge, you know, it all went as well as you could be expected, and that's when it was like, great, let's move this thing to Broadway.
Yeah, I remember the thing that I always just loved about that show coming to Broadway was, you know, you hear about theater being such a difficult business. It's a difficult business for actors, for writers, for producers, for everyone. Yeah. And you know, there's a huge there's a lot of just guesswork and kind of just throwing shit against walls and seeing what sticks. And I mean, you read or you think about what Hand of God is about, and you just think, what an absurd premise for a play. But it's just one of those magical things where it seems like all the puzzle pieces came together.
Well, I kind of have a theory that like every piece of theater that's like a really great, memorable piece of theater, if you like come up with the log line for what it is, it sounds insane. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds bananas, right. you know? It's like if someone was like, yeah, I'm going to do this rock version of a Puccini opera.
Yeah.
But they're all going to, like, live on the Lower Side. You'd be like, good luck.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? It's like...
right, you know.
And now, obviously, we think, like, oh, that's Rent. That's a huge hit, and that's everyone knows that. So, Hand of God was a lot
John has thoughts.
Sorry. But it's okay. But I get what you mean, because, you know, it's like Fun Home. It's like, lesbian cartoonist's dad kills himself.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Go.
So it's like there was no reason for that show to work as well as it did. Mm. It just worked because it was like a awesome play, because Rob Astin is a phenomenal writer, and the cast was spectacular.
Stellar, out of this world.
And it just was really visceral and kind of raw and emotional and real, for lack of a better word. And that's the thing. The thing I think that misconception about producers is like, we're not the writer and we're not the director and we're not the actors, and we can do the best we can to steer the project in the way. But at the end of the day, like, it all has to kind of gel in the way. So it's like, you know, I get defensive when people see some theater and they're like, how could this have happened? And you're like, well, there's a lot of ways to answer that question.
Totally.
But like, when 5 years ago, you know, someone said, I'm going to produce this and let's go for this, you know, there's a lot of twists and turns in the road that you can, you know, sometimes you look back and say, oh, maybe we should have taken the other way. But the intention is always to make really good theater.
Right.
So sometimes you get lucky and you have a Hand of God where it like all gels together in a way that feels really special.
Yeah.
That's
very true. I mean, the number of shows that just looked so good on paper that have just blown up in our faces.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember to this day how bonkers excited we all were for Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, like with that team, with that cast, with that source material. Like, this is of course going to sweep the Tony Awards. Like, why is anything else coming out that year?
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, there are elements of it that were really lovely, but a lot of it you watched were like, I don't think anybody was mad. I think everyone was sort of just sad. Like, this, something went wrong at some point. And when you're in the room, it's hard to sometimes see, like, what's the term? Like, you can't see your hand for your face or whatever that term is. I don't know.
Yeah.
You can't see the forest for the trees.
Hand face?
You can't see your hand to God face.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're in the craziness, and sometimes you can't see what's happening, and then you put it up. And I know, I mean, I have friends who've worked on stuff for other Broadway shows that, like, I remember them being in rehearsals going, this is really, I think what we have is really good. And I went and saw it, and I very politely was like, congratulations, I'm so happy for you, but, like, and these are people with very good taste who've done other really great stuff. No one bats 100, and it's a lot of it is trying to gel and luck, and you know, talent and intellect only get you so far.
Yeah, no, I mean the beauty and the thing that is wonderful and also the most frustrating about theater is that like it requires other people to do. Like it is not like writing a book where it's like just you know what I mean?
Like, right, even a one-man show like Mike Birbiglia, hundreds of people.
Lots of people. Yeah. So it's like every single show is a collaboration. It doesn't matter who you are or what you want to do or like how important you are, like you have to collaborate with other people. Mm-hmm. And so every collaboration is different, and some are really fruitful and some or not. And it's an interesting thing working on a show because it's like you have to kind of drink the Kool-Aid on some level, or else like you just would not be able to put yourself into it the way that you want to. I think part of a producer's job is to like be be like the ultimate audience member and be able to say like be able to articulate the parts of a show that maybe aren't working as an audience member. But you know, most audience members don't go see a show and they leave and they're like, I think my emotional attachment to that person's arc wasn't as strong as it needed to be, and they lost me
right.
in the second part of Act 2. Like that's not how a normal right. person thinks. They're just like, I liked it or I loved it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a lot of our job is to be in those rooms and kind of talk to the creative team about our experience as an audience member mm-hmm. I was just going to say as articulately as possible as I stumbled over all of my words. as articulately as possible.
So I read Broadway World a lot. Broadway World is a tragic place and I love it so much. I used to have an account. Actually, I think I got made my account through your old email address.
Possibly.
Lucas and I have known each other for a very long time.
Long time.
But I haven't posted anything in years. I just love to read it. And I love to read super uninformed opinions on things like it's fact because sometimes people just give bonkers explanations for things. So, for example, this week we've had two announcements of separate Broadway shows closing.
Sure.
The Band's Visit and Anastasia.
Uh-huh.
Band's Visit has mostly been, for lack of a better term, older people who know the business and how things work, understanding why it's closing. Like, they read mm-hmm. the grosses and they go, of course. Anastasia has a younger following, and so their younger fan base tried to come up with reasons for its closing other than the fact that it was no longer making money. And as someone who has been involved in the day-to-day, I would like you to settle some scores for me in terms of running costs and grosses.
Sure.
Please, for our younger listeners, as we've now established we have.
Sure.
Somebody said, and I quote, "Do you think one of the reasons is they couldn't find someone as good as Christy Altomare to replace her as Anastasia, and that's why they're closing?" Is that something, if we're not talking like a star vehicle, like Patti LuPone is Anastasia, we're talking about like somebody, a very good actor.
That would sell tickets.
Would sell tickets. Like if you, so like.
Would attend.
Journey to the LuPone.
Journey to the LuPone. But so like, let's say, for example, Something Rotten, uh-huh. Brian D'Arcy James, phenomenal actor, but it is not like marquee name.
Sure.
Would you consider closing the show because you were unable to find someone who you found to be as suitable as he is?
So just to say, I will speak for myself. I do not know I do not work on Anastasia, so mm-hmm. I do not know their reasons. And every show and every producer has their own reasons. That being said, if you're asking me, probably not. I mean, I think that if you are, a show, that is like, I'll say this because this would be an extreme example, but like for like Mike Birbiglia's show,
sure.
Like, mm-hmm. if Mike is no longer able to perform the show, like we're not looking for someone else to perform the show,
yeah.
but it's him, you know.
It's his show.
And there's several shows I think that are kind of built around the presence of one person that are larger shows. One that comes to mind, also not a show I worked on, but I think a huge part of the draw and the event of the audience with Helen Mirren playing that part.
Yeah.
So in that case, when Helen Mirren no longer can play the part, they're looking at that's,
yeah.
you know, and that was a hugely successful show. But they're like, we're not going to try to find someone else who's going to reach this level. For a show that is a long running musical, for Something Rotten, for those other shows, we wouldn't close the show because, one of the leads was there's a lot of talented people out there. There's a lot mm-hmm, of people you mm-hmm. can find. Closing a show is, another perhaps misconception about producing. Closing a show is an incredibly painful process.
Sure.
I think people think it's this very like flip, like we're not making money anymore, so we're closing it down.
Yeah.
There are shows that close or announce a closing when they're still doing fine, or they might have had a couple losing weeks, but there's other weeks that are good, and they decide, we're going to announce a closing because we feel like that is the natural trajectory of where we're going, and we'd rather announce a closing and create some compression between when we announced and when we closed, so we're going to have good weeks between then.
Sure.
A good example of that is Motown, actually. We decided to close Motown. I think we gave a 6 months notice on the closing of Motown, and we were still making money when the show was, when we announced closing. It was not like we had started to lose money in the weeks. But I think we looked at the advance, we looked how things were going, and we looked at what the running costs of the show were, and we really thought, we think we can announce 6 months out that we're closing and give ourselves and have really great business in that time and recoup the show and have a really phenomenal tour, which was starting, and then bring the show mm-hmm. back to Broadway in a year or so. And that's exactly what we did. So mm-hmm. that was what, that was really, so it was really much more of a strategic plan. And I think we were super open, in the press about being like, this is the plan. This is our strategic plan.
I remember that. Yeah.
And we're just really, cause a lot of people were very surprised based on the grosses that we were announcing a closing. So it always has to, you know, announcing closing almost always has to do with looking at the, financial picture of your show and how best to maximize it. And it's complicated, but in a lot of ways, a lot simpler in that, you know, you have a certain, as I said, like one of the beauties and frustrating parts of theater is that like everyone has to show up every day to do their work.
Right.
There's hundreds of people who go to a Broadway theater every day just to do one show. And you have to pay all those people and you have to pay them a living wage because they deserve a living wage. And so the costs are expensive and there's a lot of other, you have to pay your rental fees for your lights and your sound. You have to pay for the labor. You have to pay for costume repairs.
You're barreling into it by my next question was going to be.
Great.
John knows what this is going to be. Another one is people's misconceptions on running costs.
Yes.
So another thing that I love to read whenever the grosses come up on something, people saying, oh, such and such as grosses were low this week, but this should be fine, right? Its running costs can't be high. They only have one set.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming for all shows, your running cost is not determined by whether you have one or two set pieces. It's determined by many other things.
It's not. It's a huge. It's a lot of different things.
Yes.
It's a lot of different factors. I mean, even on a one person show, mm-hmm. there are a ton of different factors that determine your running costs. It's a long list. You could have one set of a show, but you could have three people in the show who are all making a significant amount of money because they're stars. You know what I mean? Or you could have a show that, you know, a lot of people don't think, like, a show, the maintenance on big musicals, on costumes and on wigs, it's like, it's huge. You know, if you have a 24-person show, and let's just say the show is a period show.
Oh, my God.
That's so many costumes, a lot of upkeep, that's a lot of wigs, that's a lot of labor you have to pay to upkeep all that stuff, not to mention the fact that every time someone leaves the show and someone new shows up on the show, they need an entire new set of costumes.
Mm-hmm.
Every understudy needs an entire set of costumes for when they go on for a different part. Like, there's a ton of moving parts.
Yeah. But one rule that is true is you do not get charged per set piece in your show. I'm just letting that be known now.
Whoever posted that on Broadway
World,
Matt's coming for your gig. Matt's here to give you the business.
That's why I'm
telling
you.
He's here to say, you're wrong.
I'm not devoid of culture, but my feet are on the floor. It's a business.
It's a business.
I do the Kama Sutra with a Richard Rodgers score. That's good.
I don't want to say that listening to this podcast episode will get you cast on Broadway, but we do have a Broadway producer here. Just saying.
We also have both of our headshots placed directly in front of him on the table, and I've already slipped a couple in his coat.
Without naming any names, Lucas,
yes.
Have people from your past been like, so, oh my God, congratulations, here's my headshot. Had people done that to you?
I'll actually say no one has actually done that to me.
That's great.
I have had a couple people, which I am completely fine with, saying like, can you help me get an appointment for a show that I'm working on? Which is like, and as everyone knows, it's like that by no means means you're going to get a callback or anything.
Right.
But I'm like pretty much always happy to be like, yeah, and tell the casting director to get an appointment. So I've gotten that. I've gotten no one, like, very strangely, who I haven't talked to in years, saying that. What I have gotten a lot of is people, and this is mostly my mother's fault, learning what house seats are and coming out of the woodwork.
Sure.
It's like, hey, remember me?
Oh my
was so-and-so's parent that you went to third grade with. I'd love to see this show.
Even shows that aren't your shows? Like
mostly.
Yeah, like how am I get into Hamilton? God.
Mostly.
People think you are the ticket master.
Yeah. Like they exactly. think that you They're are like, oh, this is a thing you can do. I will say this is funny actually, just because this wouldn't be in a podcast if I didn't talk about some quirk of my mother in some way or fashion. But she used to call me for tickets to my shows, and she would be like, I would get a call at work. Like the receptionist would be like, your mother's on the phone, and I'd be like,
she would call the office.
She'd call the office.
Your personal, love that.
And I'd be like, why are you calling the office? And she'd be like, well, this is about work. And I'd be like, okay. And she'd be like, okay, do you remember Teresa? I'm like, no, who is she? She's like,
Teresa.
She's like, she's my friend. And remember, she also, anyway, she recently got divorced and she's been really depressed about that. And so her daughter is home from college and they're taking a girls trip to New York and they haven't really had a lot of time together. And, the daughter's had a tough semester as well, right? You know, she thought she was going to be in pre-med, but anyway, she's not going to be in pre-med.
Oh,
she has this whole awakening, so they're going through a tough time. Anyway, they're going to New York, and they were wondering if they could get some house seats to Play That Goes Wrong. I was like, Mom, you do not need to lobby for these people to get to, like, to pay for tickets to see my show. Like, don't even, just send it to the house seat email address.
Yeah.
I don't even need to know they're coming. But she would come up with like a very long
PowerPoint presentation
about why they should be considered for a house seat.
Please tell me what you just told us was verbatim what she said. Because if that was all improv, bravo.
It actually, it was improv. But
Stage
with,
Door Manor Training. Is that what that place was called? Backdoor Stage, Manor?
It
Stage
was. Backdoor Manor.
But that was it for you, though. But I don't know.
That is not verbatim. Teresa is fictional, and I did make her up, and I did make up her daughter. But it's a template, because like that is, I got that call so many times, and it was always like a variation of that. And you would just be like, I'd be like, I don't need to know any of this information. She can just come. Like, she's in.
She got it.
It was like the Bachelor, where it was like, what tragic backstory does this person need to have to advance to the next round? I was like, there's no rounds. Just like, she can come.
I did not
All
foresee.
Are welcome.
I did not foresee us talking about the Bachelor as much on this episode as we have. We've named out the Bachelor like 10 times today.
I'm actually impressed that, because you talked about it and I love that television. It is my guilty pleasure. I'm addicted to it.
The Bachelor?
I
never watched it.
Yes. Yeah. I watch it with, well, I will say, I watch it with a group of my friends from college. We watch it like football. Like, we screen the screen.
Oh my God.
Fantasy League. And
it's really
that.
Not for the faint of heart, but it is so stupid. And when you mentioned it before, I did not say anything about it because I knew that then it would be a 2.5 hour long Bachelor podcast and we would never talk about anything else.
That should be the next thing you option for your next musical. It needs to be a musical comedy drama co-directed by Casey Nicholl and Eva Van Hoffe. And it's going to be like all the, I just saw Network last night, so I have like that staging of all the screens everywhere and the cameras. It needs to be that, but like with Casey Nicholl tap dancing. So,
actually sounds great.
I see it. Yeah.
You heard it here, bitches. Do you have any projects coming up that you can talk about?
We're working on a couple shows that we have announced. One is Devora's Prada.
With Stage Door alum Shayna Taub.
It all goes back to Stage Door.
It fucking does.
I love her.
With Shayna Taub and a young upstart named Elton John.
I was going to say something.
And Paul Rudnick. I'm very excited about that. We're working on that. We're working on Mrs. Doubtfire.
That's the
whole time. The whole time. The whole time.
Yeah. We're also working on The Notebook with Ingrid Michaelson.
Okay.
And Becca Brunstetter. And those are the ones we've announced. And then we have a bunch of other stuff. I'm working on a bunch of other stuff. That I just optioned a book I'm really excited about that'll come down the road soon. Those are kind of early development stuff. But
brilliant.
Those are the titles that are out there at the moment. So
beautiful.
Look forward to those.
Yes. Where can people find you on the meads?
Oh, God. You can find me on Instagram.
He doesn't post often.
I do not post often. But, actually, for a while, I not only had not posted anything, but I was also private for no reason. Just because I thought it was funny when people had to request to follow me and then, like, found out. It was like sending people presents with, like, nothing in them. They were like, I had to request him, and yet there's nothing here to look at.
Literally nothing.
Now I do post, and I am no longer private. So yeah. You can find me there. I believe I'm Lucas.McMahon on Instagram. Sure. That's pretty much it. I believe I have a Twitter account that has gone unattended to for about 5.5 years. So don't follow me there.
No.
Or
don't
do.
Your choice.
But, you know, it's not going to be very entertaining. That's where you can find me.
Fantastic. Awesome. That's where you can find
or
Lucas.
Roaming the streets of New York.
Yes. Yeah. In a power suit and tie. yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So that's it for our podcast today, everybody. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, rate us 5 stars, write us a review. I am still waiting for our next review. We've had some super
games. He's so thirsty for these reviews.
I'm so thirsty for
ridiculous.
I've challenged everybody. I'm like, write us something fucking gay, because we've had some gay ass reviews calling us out for how gay we are, and I'm just waiting for the next one. If you can, please reference Audra McDonald or Smile the Musical. One of the two, I'll be pleased.
Oh my gosh.
Lucas, every episode we close ourselves out with a nice big Broadway diva. Would you like to do the honors this episode?
Why don't we do, you know, I'm doing this to spite someone. It's you, Allie Paris. That's Lilias White.
Never done her. Pick it.
That's such a good idea.
Good. I've been waiting to have that one. I said that like it wasn't.
Like you don't have control.
I did it. Yeah, fantastic.
Yes, and I managed to call out someone, one of my friends, in the process.
Hello, Allie Paris.
What a great choice. What
that
a
is
great
a phenomenal
stab in the dark.
I'm so happy.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
Yes, this has been amazing. This has been Broadway Breakdown. I'm Matt Koplik.
I'm done with the game.
I'm Lucas.
He's
Lucas McCann.
I'm Lucas.
And I was here too.
He was here too. And this is Lilias White. Take us away, Lilias. Bye. Bye.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.